Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Dan Lefkowitz, strategist for Morningstar Indexes. Our guest this week is Brian Selmo. Brian is a portfolio manager and research director at First Pacific Advisors. Since 2013, he has co-managed the FPA Crescent Fund with Steve Romick and Mark Landecker. And in 2021, he became co-manager of the FPA Global Equity ETF. Both strategies are highly regarded by Morningstar's manager research team. Before joining FPA in 2008, Brian worked as an analyst at Third Avenue Management and at Rothschild, and was founder and portfolio manager of Eagle Lake Capital. Brian holds a degree from Johns Hopkins. Brian, thanks so much for joining us in The Long View.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, we really appreciate you making some time for the podcast and sharing your perspective. We are recording this in late June 2025, and markets have settled down, but we did see some very sharp drawdowns earlier this year in stocks and tremors in the treasury market. And, you know, a couple terms that have trended this year are volatility and uncertainty. I'm curious what your message is for investors who've been unsettled by volatility and uncertainty.
Yeah, sure, Dan. You know, this is a question that would have come up a lot during our first quarter conference call, which was held shortly after Liberation Day. And, you know, our feeling is that uncertainty is sort of a constant and intrinsic part of the human experience. And it just reflects the fact that there are a lot more things that could happen than will happen. And that uncertainty is sort of kind of a definition of risk from our perspective. And I think there's actually, you know, people kind of, as you said, it trends and people say, how can you deal with all this uncertainty that exists today? And, you know, there's so much uncertainty. What are you going to do? And our thought would be there's always been uncertainty. And there was actually a long time ago, I read a book by Bob Rubin called In an Uncertain World. And, you know, sort of the premise of it, and he had, I think, something like a 40-year career at that point in, you know, government and having previously run Goldman Sachs before being Treasury Secretary. And his premise was basically that, you know, you can't really know anything for certain before you make a decision. You sort of have to deal with the facts you have and reasonable probabilities around, you know, likely outcomes, and then, you know, make the best decision you can, you know, given that you live in an uncertain world. And so that's, I think, an idea that's sort of always been a pretty robust way to approach, you know, financial markets and probably geopolitical issues as well. So what we want to do is, instead of predicting any, you know, particular outcome, which, you know, I think we would say is basically impossible, we want to prepare for any manner of eventualities. And so, you know, if you think about our Crescent Fund, you know, we are endeavoring for equity-like returns with less risk over rolling market cycles and over rolling five-year periods. And we do that by having a number of different types of investments, you know, some that will do well in, you know, a given scenario, and maybe others that will do well in other scenarios. And so we want to take advantage of the volatility that, you know, as part of capital markets, equity markets, and be able to buy, you know, stocks and bonds when we think they offer good value. And then, you know, sort of buy businesses and bonds that we would expect to do well in any number of circumstances. So things that can kind of, you know, ride well no matter what the tide happens to look like. We don't tend to do a lot of changing of our mind or changing of, you know, the portfolio in response to, you know, some item that's in the news at a given point in time.
Yeah, yeah. There was a great line in your first quarter commentary that I highlighted. You have not entrusted us with your hard-earned capital to opine on public policy, but to do the best with the hand that we are dealt. I thought that was good.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So you're very much fundamental bottom-up investors, but you do describe yourselves as macro aware. So I wanted to ask if you've made any sort of adjustments to the portfolio based on expectations around economic growth or inflation or geopolitical risk.
Yeah, you know, and specifically with regard to, you know, growth and geopolitical risk, the short answer is no. And the reason is that, you know, we're seeking to find, you know, easy problems to solve and try to avoid hard or impossible problems. And I tend to think that coming up with a useful, you know, differentiated expectation for growth or inflation expectations is basically impossible. And And when I say useful, I mean, you know, both different from consensus and also a view in which you have enough kind of conviction or certainty that you'd be willing to risk capital behind it. So that's not, you know, something, you know, that we can do. You know, what we do, you know, just sort of at a day-to-day basis is we're, you know, building and maintaining a universe of high quality franchise businesses. And we're looking for, you know, a chance to buy them. You know, think of these as compounders. You know, my partner Mark says that we're looking for, you know, compounders that are clouded in controversy. And so you're going to get a chance to buy those kind of businesses when there's some kind of doubt about them.
Yeah.
And you want to have done the work and have thought about what your anchors to windward are, or what are the durable characteristics of the investment before, you know, the news events start trying to, you know, throw things into a volatile twist. It's very hard to, you know, get one's conviction if you are sort of just learning or coming up the learning curve in a very volatile environment. So instead, we try to prepare ahead of time and then respond to the opportunities that come on offer when, you know, some macro issue comes to the fore. In terms of being macro aware, what we're really doing is looking to understand where there are areas of clear excess, and it could be, you know, a lot of enthusiasm or, you know, high-priced or overpriced securities. And then we're also, or maybe, you know, excessive credit risk. And then we're also looking for, you know, areas that we think are deeply depressed compared to sort of long-term sustainable levels. And so we want to, you know, avoid the first, right, where we think there's too much froth. A lot of what we're doing in Crescent is, you know, winning by not losing. So we want to avoid areas of the market, whether it's equities, whether it's geographies, whether it's industries, that, you know, the risk reward or the price to value doesn't make any sense. And given our flexibility, you know, we're able to be completely out of various sectors, industries, or businesses. And then on the other hand, you know, when a business or an industry is out of favor, operating well below trend, or faces sort of some challenges, you know, that's a place we want to sift around for opportunity or for investments.
Yeah. So, as you said, the Crescent team has used market sell-offs historically as buying opportunities. And the tariff-driven sell-off that we saw earlier this year didn't last that long. It wasn't a huge drawdown, but curious if you were net buyers of risk assets during the period.
Yeah, we were net buyers. I think, you know, we bought a couple hundred basis points in equities, and it was primarily adding to, you know, businesses that we had been buying over the previous 12 months. So it was a handful of Japanese businesses, and then probably 7 or 8 businesses that are domiciled, you know, around the world, primarily in Europe and the U.S. And, you know, those businesses range from, you know, electronics businesses, consumer staples, energy services, leisure companies, building materials, and, you know, maybe one, you know, commodity producer. And so there's not really any unifying industry or geography around the businesses that we've been buying. But the thing that does kind of unite them all is they're all sort of small to mid-cap companies. Hmm. None of them have market caps above $30 billion. And I think they would, you know, be considered classically good businesses, right? Strong mm-hmm. returns on invested capital, strong margins, you know, large shares. And in niches where, you know, we think the prospects for growth over the next, call it 5 or 10 years, are pretty sound. And so all the businesses, you know, have strong balance sheets. I think on the management team side, they're somewhere between acceptable to great management teams. And then I think the thing that really makes them attractive to us is, given the high quality nature of the companies, they're all selling for between 8 and 14 times earnings when we bought them. You know, on the credit side, you know, we did not do anything directly in response to, you know, Liberation Day or the tariffs. You know, subsequently, we've done one credit that I think is, you know, was attractive as a result of sort of some, you know, uncertainty or change in government policy with regard to wireless spectrum. But, you know, just broadly in the public credit side, you know, spreads were about as tight as they'd ever been, you know, at the end of February, end of March. They widened maybe to slightly tighter than normal for maybe a week or two during, you know, the little bit of volatility we had in April. Mm-hmm. And then they've come right back, and the credit market is wide open. And so we've kind of been, you know, very limited in the amount of credit we've been investing in the last sort of 12 months. And so I was, you know, encouraged to hear Jamie Dimon say, I think a week ago or something, that if he was a portfolio manager, he would kind of avoid credit in his portfolio. So that hopefully adds some credibility to the position we've had for a while.
Yeah. You mentioned finding opportunity in the mid-cap or small to mid-cap space. You know, generally large caps have outperformed smaller caps over the past, you know, 10, 15 years or so. Do you find more attractive valuations down the cap spectrum?
We do. You know, if we look over the last year, we have been, you know, very much net sellers of large and mega cap companies and buyers of mid-cap companies. And I think there's probably, you know, there's always idiosyncratic reasons, but it feels like there are maybe some, you know, larger drivers of that. I think that sort of the natural buyers of mid-cap companies, whether it is, you know, active mutual fund managers or long short hedge fund managers, I think that those managers have seen tremendous outflows from their strategies over the last 10 or 15 years to a point where the industry is almost dead.
Yeah.
And where you've seen a lot of inflows is, you know, one, as a competitor to sort of buying these businesses would be private equity. But private equity has, you know, probably been a little bit out of the market the last year or two because of the increase in interest rate. And then, you know, also the, you know, sort of failure to recycle capital and maybe a little bit of limited appetite. But the other issues have been, you know, the huge flow into passives, and that tends to disproportionately go towards large and mega cap companies. And then I think the other bit is the kind of dominance of pod shops in terms of trading flows and just assets under management over the last decade. And those are, at least on, as I understand it, on the equity side, they're not really natural holders of companies with lower levels of liquidity, because in order to sort of run the kind of perfectly hedge neutral model, you really need to be able to get in and out of positions pretty quickly. And so, you know, when you have a lot of the market move away from being, you know, call it bottoms up fundamental long-term holders, I think that's creating an opportunity. And it's an opportunity that, you know, we're very, I think well situated to take advantage of. And it's something that we're pretty optimistic about, you know, over the next, call it 3 or 4 years or until, you know, something else changes.
Yeah. Wanted to ask about geography. As you mentioned, you're very much a global investor. You own businesses in Europe and Japan and Korea. U.S. has obviously outperformed, again, going back 10, 15 years. Do you find more compelling valuations outside of the U.S. than within generally? Do you have a perspective on kind of the long run of outperformance of U.S.?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that it's a little bit hard to say because we don't invest from a macro basis, from top-down basis. We follow businesses by their industry or competitive set, and we follow them across geographies. So the people who cover a particular business niche would certainly not stop their analysis at sort of a geographic border. They would cover that entire, you know, value chain. And then we would invest really open-mindedly across, you know, wherever the companies might be domiciled, you know, considering the valuation, considering the competitive position, and considering, you know, the management quality and maybe shareholder friendliness. And so I think that we have over the last couple of years been buying more things that are domiciled internationally, but it's not necessarily a comment that, you know, generally market A is cheaper than market B.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in terms of understanding some of the, you know, outperformance of the U.S. over the last, call it 10, 15 years, I mean, I think the punchline is a lot of it's earned. And I think there's a couple of things that went into it. I think one is that, you know, the starting point after the financial crisis was at the time of certainly reasonable valuations in U.S. markets, and the currency wasn't particularly expensive. And, you know, a lot of emerging markets at the time, and even international markets in general, their economies, they benefited proportionately a lot more from the commodity super cycle. And you might remember, but, you know, there was a, I guess there weren't memes at the time, but there was a theme at the time that there was going to be a decoupling and that the BRICS were going to kind of pull the world ahead and decouple from, you know, the US and maybe from Europe. And so I think that's all, you know, largely reversed. And that's probably a bit of a cyclical, you know, experience where, you know, you see different markets, outperform for a decade and underperform. And that's kind of ebbed and flowed, I think, off and on for the last 100 years. The thing or the issue that's maybe a little bit different in the last 10 or 15 years from my perspective is, you know, I'd call it Silicon Valley funded, tech platforms.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, putting a, what amounts to, you know, from our childhood, what amounts to a supercomputer into, you know, 5-6 billion people's hands has created business opportunities on a scale and a profit sort of profile, you know, the likes of which just didn't exist, prior to, let's say, the opportunity didn't exist prior to 2010. And if we think about ex-China, almost all of the important firms that have succeeded, you know, on building those platforms are U.S. domiciled. And so they're going to be in U.S. indexes. And then when you have sort of the power law of, you know, success accruing to the few, you know, you have a result of where real economic activity in terms of business performance, a lot of their activity is actually happening globally, but in terms of where the companies are domiciled that are experiencing all of this very real business value growth, that's just been in the U.S. market. So I think it, you know, it's only natural if you have that, that that market would outperform.
Yeah.
You know, we started talking, you know, uncertainty. Just because that's been what happened the last 10 or 15 years, it certainly doesn't mean that's what will happen in the next 10 or 15 years. And, you know, AI is I think, very likely to be, you know, a new tech platform, right? A new compute platform. Mm. And when you, historically, when you've had new platforms, such as the mobile platform, that's created a, you know, a change in the landscape and an opportunity for new businesses, you know, to create very, very big, you know, profit pools and new type of, you know, economic dominance in some way. And so, you know, I don't know where the dominant AI companies will be developed, and they very well could be developed, you know, outside of the U.S. You know, it's maybe not the betting odds because Silicon Valley is still, you know, very well funded and probably, you know, at least now in pole position to win with AI. But, you know, it creates another, you know, shot at things for other, you know, geographies in terms of where these businesses might get built.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about AI, how FPA is thinking about it, and whether it's core to your investment thesis for any of your holdings. Looks like you've got Meta and Alphabet, Amazon, some semiconductor manufacturers.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. One, a lot of humility in terms of thinking about what you don't know. But, you know, two, I think as a firm, we want to embrace it as much as possible. So we want to, you know, be listening to podcasts by people who are leaders in the industry. We want to be reading about people's perspective and insight into what might be possible with this technology. We want to, you know, certainly use it and incorporate it into our work when we have tools that are useful. And that's both on the, you know, investment research side, but also on the operating the business side. And so, you know, we use various AI tools, you know, as an organization already. And I only expect that to, you know, increase. And then I think personally, you want to experiment with them as much as you can. You know, on the investing side, I think what's really important for any investment, but particularly kind of, you know, like I said, a likely paradigm shift or platform shift in a technology is you want to be sort of creative and, you know, broad in how you think about what might happen, right? You want to, you know, entertain the what maybe seems implausible, because it's sort of usually the failure of imagination, you know, that gets you into trouble, right? It's imagining or making an assumption that something implicit often that something won't or can't happen, and then it sneaks up and surprises you later. So we want to, you know, be as imaginative as possible in terms of thinking about what businesses and what you know, activities might be challenged. And then, you know, we would like to, you know, certainly have various exposures to things that we think would benefit from AI, but particularly we want to focus on those things that we think are going to be durable and not change in light of AI, because it's the things that you can get sort of a confidence in not changing that you can really, you know, build a position or build a business around. You know, in terms of the companies that we own in the Mag 7, you mentioned Amazon, Meta, and Alphabet. I think to date, Amazon and Meta are generally viewed as beneficiaries, you know, from AI. And I think that Alphabet faces a, you know, a very obvious risk. And I think just so everyone's level set, I mean, Alphabet is a number of different businesses. You know, there's cloud, there's YouTube, there's search as you think about it. And then there's some of the other bets, and Waymo's maybe starting to come into its own in terms of the other bets.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the best part of the, you know, Google business, the 10 blue links, is probably not going to be as good a business the next 10 years as it was the last 10 years. And so that creates, you know, uncertainty and risk. I would say that, you know, to some degree, that's, I think, well identified and probably incorporated in the stock price to some degree. I think there was a presentation a week ago by a very prominent, you know, hedge fund manager who's also involved in big way in growth equities and venture. And, you know, I think Alphabet and Apple were kind of his picks to no longer be top 30 businesses over the next decade, or maybe even in the next 5 years. And so I don't think it's lost on anyone. I think that it's also worth remembering that a lot of these companies, you know, have reinvented themselves over time. I mean, I would say that, you know, no one really uses original blue Facebook anymore, but that hasn't prevented, you know, what is now Meta from remaining a very relevant and valuable business. Mm-hmm. And so I think from our perspective, the big question mark at Alphabet is how is management going to handle this? And, you know, I think to date, they have probably not covered themselves in glory, but certainly it should be front page now for them, and hopefully they will execute well.
And then your positions in semiconductor manufacturers, is that sort of picks and shovels play on AI?
Yeah, we've owned, you know, some, you know, so call it power and analog semiconductor businesses, you know, for a number of years, really going back, I think, oh, probably 10, 12 years in the case of ADI. And so, you know, those are largely picks and shovels, or you can think about them almost as a toll on the digitization of the world. And, you know, we think that that's a very durable long-term trend. AI is, you know, I think going to benefit and accelerate that trend. But, you know, we got into all of those well before, you know, AI was sort of front and center and at valuations that, you know, made a lot of sense.
Okay. And then how are you thinking about regulatory risk in the context of some of these Mag 7 holdings? There's been some antitrust actions.
You know, it's another uncertainty. I think that, you know, we will see what the, you know, the impact is. I think there, for some companies, there's a thesis to be had that if you broke them up into their component pieces, that maybe they would be worth more than where they trade in the markets. But we don't take a particular view on how the regulatory environment will play out. We think that the, you know, the asset bases that the companies have and the financial wherewithal they have and the various, you know, business, you know, discrete businesses within the companies are all probably strong enough to be, you know, certainly Fortune 500 companies on their own. And so, you know, we suspect that it might not be the end of the world if they were to get, you know, rearranged a little bit organizationally. Mm-hmm. And it might even create some energy and focus from the management teams. I mean, there's a, you know, I don't think many people believe that Alphabet is the, you know, best managed, most lean, you know, financially or a commercially aggressive organization in the world. And so, you know, having a little bit of the wolf at the door might be helpful for them.
Going back to the opportunities you've been finding in the small and mid-cap space, the compounders that you've been adding to recently, wondering if you would be willing to share a couple names and walk us through the thesis.
Yeah, sure. You know, I suppose the I'll start with the one that's the most fun, you know, being a user of the product. So, you know, over the last, you know, call it 6 months, we had an opportunity to buy what we think of as a, you know, unique trophy asset in Vail Resorts at what are very undemanding prices. And the, you know, very simple thesis is that there have not really been new ski resorts developed over the last 50 years. We think that people's propensity to ski is a pretty durable, you know, human desire. And over time, we would suspect that the company can, you know, manage the, you know, revenue base and price their product in a way that that slightly exceeds inflation, and that ought to allow for a bit of a, you know, margin benefit. And you have a business trading at, you know, as we said, somewhere between 8 and 14 times earnings, and, you know, redistributing just about all of that cash to shareholders in the form of dividends and buybacks. So I think that, you know, the math works, and we think it's an asset that, you know, no matter what happens with AI, is likely to remain relevant. So, you know, that's one that we've been doing.
Can I ask with that one, do you think climate change concerns have kind of weighed on the share price at all?
I think they do weigh on it from time to time. I mean, I think the interesting thing to point out there is, I'd say a few things. There is always a scenario where an investment won't work out, right? So there's no sort of perfect investment in my mind. And there is a, you know, if for some reason the world does not produce enough cold days for skiing, that will make their business, you know, irrelevant, non-viable. I would, though, say that when people talk about this as a near-term issue, this is a little bit of a headline divorce from fact. And so the reality is that the number of skiing days generally in North America has gone up over the last decade and over the last 2 decades, so meaning the number of days that the resorts are open. And then secondly, the Vail Resort Mountains have actually increased their skier days by more than the industry over the last 10 or 20 years. So the actual amount of, call it, skiing days produced has gone up, not down, despite the kind of concerns around climate. And the reason for that is largely because of the snowmaking capabilities and capacities at a lot of these resorts. And being the best capitalized and best invested in, you know, Vail has actually, on a relative basis, even benefited vis-a-vis the rest of the industry. And so it's certainly something that would cause the investment, you know, to not work over a very long period of time. But I think in the more near term, it certainly hasn't been an impact, I think, on the business in terms of, you know, days that the mountain is open.
Gotcha.
I think another business that, you know, we bought over the last, you know, 6 or 12 months is a company in Europe called Eurofins. And this is a business that does, you know, testing for, you know, call it life, what they would call. And so this is, whether it's environmental testing, whether it's around drugs that are being developed, or whether it's around, you know, various materials or in the food chain. They kind of ensure that sort of the environment, the food or the medicines people are taking are safe, and then also allow people to, you know, innovate in those fields and kind of get quick results. And it's an owner operator who we think is, you know, built a terrific network and franchise, and over time is going to, you know, accrue the benefits of the, you know, long-term trend of a greater interest in, you know, sort of a clean environment and a, you know, robust food chain and biologic and health innovation, right? So those are kind of long-term trends that we think ought to underpin the growth of the business. And the organization is well set up to be a cost leader because they've developed their own, you know, IT system in-house. And we think that that's going to give them a little bit of a benefit. And over a fixed cost base, if they can, you know, manage those costs a little bit better, that'll be some margin benefit. And then again, we got into it on a non-demanding multiple with the management team that is actively buying back stock and paying dividends. So we think the math will work there too.
Very interesting. That healthcare sector overall seems like it's kind of derated. Have you been finding opportunity?
You know, we've gone from, you know, about zero in healthcare, you know, during, not about, we've gone from zero in healthcare, you know, during kind of the COVID mania to now a few, you know, let's say a little over 3%. And what's interesting about that is that back in 2012, that's kind of like the peak fear of Obamacare, you know, healthcare was our largest exposure. And then as, you know, valuations got to points that we thought were kind of untenable, we just exited it outright. And that's consistent with how we invest in sort of across the board, right? If we think the opportunities are good, we're happy to invest. If we think that the, you know, risk reward doesn't make sense or everything's overpriced, you know, we don't have any preconceived notion that we have to be somewhere. So we'll go to zero exposure. You know, currently, I would say we're most interested in the picks and shovels in the healthcare business. And these are really companies that, you know, help develop, you know, pharmaceuticals or biologics or produce them. And I think that, you know, they're probably pretty well established as high quality franchise businesses. There's a bit of a maybe cyclical slowdown and some uncertainty given the, you know, changing posture at, you know, Department of Health and Human Services. But long term, you know, I think we're very bullish on healthcare spending because, you know, if you go back to what's durable, you know, for a given level of efficiency, you're assuming that incremental spend can be done productively. You know, it's incredibly societally positive to invest more and more money into improved, you know, health and longevity or health span. And so we think that, you know, it's pretty healthy for an economy to, you know, ultimately spend more of discretionary capital, you know, in that field. And we think that that trend is kind of going to continue kind of forever, as long as there are good prospects for that spend. And coming back to AI, one of the big promises of AI is going to be an increase in the number of, you know, opportunities or development pipelines or development ideas, you know, in various, you know, call it cutting edge, you know, biologic, you know, cell and gene therapy. And so I think if anything, you know, the future is very bright there. If you go out, you know, T+5 or T+10 instead of maybe, you know, the next 12 months where you got to think a little bit more about, you know, the budget cuts and maybe some loss of patent at the pharma companies where there may be some, you know, little bit of an air pocket in terms of, you know, what demand looks like shorter term.
Yeah. Going back to the global conversation we were having, you know, number of holdings in Europe and Japan, Korea as well, but not much in emerging markets. I do see Grupo Mexico in the portfolio, but it doesn't seem like you have much in India or China or Brazil, some of the big emerging markets. Is that by policy? What has kept you out?
Yeah, you know, in general, we're looking to invest in scaled, high-quality businesses, and there are just fewer of those domiciled in emerging markets. You know, we have in the past, there's no policy, I should say. You know, we have in the past had exposures, you know, in China and even in Russia. And we still actually have a little bit in China and India today. But, you know, in general, we're happy to get the exposure to those economies through multinational companies. And the more mundane businesses in those, you know, geographies tend to have a lot of state influence. They tend to maybe subject to regulatory environments that we're not comfortable with and probably are not of the business quality or shareholder alignment that we're typically looking for. And so we're, as we mentioned earlier, we're happy to kind of not do things as well if we don't think they line up.
Gotcha. You mentioned a view on the dollar earlier. Curious how kind of currency considerations factor into your investment decision-making and portfolio positioning.
Yeah, you know, I think there's two thoughts on currency. One is on the individual firm, you know, how are they matched, you know, revenue, cost, and balance sheet, and do they have sort of some risks in terms of mismatch there? And so that would be on a kind of company-specific basis. The other would be just sort of on a portfolio level, and would be interested in holding the exposure to the currency. You know, that kind of comes back to the macro question from earlier, which is, you know, we're macro aware in the sense that, you know, if we don't have a strong view that a currency is, you know, particularly unattractive, right? So if we just kind of think it's within the range of reasonable, we're prone to allow, you know, keep the exposure to the currency and get some diversification benefit. If we thought that a currency was particularly unattractive and, you know, we had some investments a decade or so ago after Fukushima in Japan and we thought the currency was particularly unattractive, you know, and there we would have hedged the currency because we had a, you know, just a sense again from the macro awareness that it wasn't a risk that we wanted to run.
I wanted to shift gears and talk a little bit about private markets, which is a very hot topic these days in the investment world. There's a lot of efforts to broaden access to smaller investors. You've owned private companies and private debt for many years now. I wonder if you could sort of share your approach to private assets.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, from an analytic perspective, it's really the same. You know, you have a different level of liquidity. I think the big positives are, you know, if we're talking about companies, and if you are able to be in a control position, you know, you have control ultimately over the management, the use of discretionary cash and strategy. And so you can, you know, meaningfully reduce the sort of principal agent challenges that you often have in public markets. Now, that's not to say there aren't many, many public companies where, you know, I probably think the governance and behavior of management is better than it is in private companies. But, you know, there's also a lot of challenge if kind of the nature of the people running the public companies aren't shareholder oriented. It's very hard to change them. Hmm. And so that's the big benefit, I think, of being private. But as a manager, you know, the real issue is around matching the liquidity of the investment to the liquidity of the, you know, assets or, yeah, that are a fund that are holding it. And so in Crescent, which is an open-ended fund, we have very, very little appetite for privates because, you know, it's a daily dealing fund. Now, we also manage a closed-end fund called Source, and Source has a large appetite relative to its size for privates, and it's actually, you know, significantly invested in private credit as well as some private equity these days. And I think that will continue because Source is, you know, essentially a locked up vehicle. And so it's an appropriate profile to own illiquid assets. Now, in Crescent, we have invested in privates over time, but these are kind of private or illiquid. I would put, you know, quotation marks around really from an SEC definition perspective rather than, you know, what I think of as in practice, you know, genuinely illiquid or private. And the reason for that is that the two big exposures we've had there is one, you know, we bought pools of defaulted mortgages after the financial crisis. And these were, you know, pools where we were the 100% owner of the assets, so we could choose to dispose of it when and how we would like. And they were self-liquidating. So they were sort of pretty liquid, even though they didn't have a CUSIP in trade. And then over the last, you know, 12 years or so, we've been investing, you know, opportunistically in ships in a number of different sectors within shipping. And this is, you know, we've got some partners who manage the buying and selling and operating of the vessels, but we're, you know, over 95% of the capital, and we just, you know, can determine the, you know, when and if we buy or when we sell. And ships are actually fairly liquid as a asset, right? They trade, you know, pretty regularly. And so we can exit our ships, I think, over, you know, no more than 60 days if we sort of needed to sell. And so that, although it shows up as private or illiquid, it's actually probably more liquid than a, you know, call it a huge stake in a small or mid-cap company.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious, with all of the, you know, institutions increasing their allocations to private equity and private credit, have you seen signs of froth in either asset class?
You know, it's a good question, and people have been talking about it for a while. I don't know that I am deeply enough involved in those markets to really comment. I mean, I think, you know, we can all see that, you know, AI-backed venture firms are getting, you know, money, it seems like, left, right, and center at very, very high apparent valuations, you know, given, you know, neither the number of people involved or how long the business has been around. But, you know, that's kind of the nature of a big gold rush around an interesting opportunity set. So whether that all proves to be a smart idea or a bad idea, I think it's way too early to tell. And on terms of the private equity, call it traditional buying of mid-cap businesses, you know, I think that's a market that's cooled a lot in the last, you know, 3 years or so. So, you know, during COVID, when rates were at zero, I think people were buying, it seemed to be that people were buying, you know, any decent business that would trade. And now I think that private equity bid is much subdued. So I'm not sure that I have a blanket statement on it.
Okay. The, you know, the common story with private credit is that, you know, increased regulation on banks after the financial crisis kind of curtailed bank lending and gave rise to private credit. It'd be interesting to kind of get your perspective on that, especially because you own some big U.S. banks.
Yeah, look, I think that's dead right. I think that we were not quick enough to identify and understand it. I think the other thing that pushed a lot of you know, private lending was just the low level of absolute rates and people's need to meet their obligations. And so there's a ton of businesses that are sort of upscale, right? I think I saw the other day 80%+ of $100 million revenue firms are private. And so, you know, it's actually terrific that the US capital markets are deep enough that they can all get funded sort of outside the banking system. And that has, I think, been what's gone on the last, you know, 10, 15 years. You know, I think we should all keep in mind that the banks back leverage a lot of those assets. And so the banks are still exposed. They're just exposed at a, you know, at a lower attachment point. And so actually in a much sort of safer position than they would have been, you know, 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. I've heard you talk in the past about how the expansion of private market investing and private equity funds have impacted public markets, especially in the small cap space. Curious how you think about the impact of private capital on public markets generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, a couple of years ago, they were a very competitive buyer for, you know, interesting mid-cap companies. I think that they're a little bit less so now. I think the other impact has been to, you know, sort of part of the sucking capital out of the, you know, call it mid-cap fund specialists and the long-short equity funds. I think that the performance of private equity has been strong enough that that's really sucked up a lot of the capital that would have previously gone to those kind of managers. Now, what I suppose is going to be interesting is that as you've had very low, you know, returns of capital, not necessarily on capital, we don't know how that will play out yet, but in terms of paying back of LPs, you know, LPs seem to be getting to a point, traditional LPs seem to be getting to a point of being tapped out on private equity and maybe for institutional specific reasons, but there's a couple of, you know, famous leaders in the space that are apparently shopping chunks of their private equity portfolio. And so, you know, if private equity isn't able to tap retail capital in a meaningful way, you know, we may be at a point where the growth in private equity starts to, you know, slow down a little bit. But, yeah, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out.
Okay. Well, my colleagues on Morningstar's manager research team pointed out to me that FPA has an investigative journalist on staff. I'm curious how that research is integrated into your investment process.
Yeah, we do. And we have had a person with a journalist background for over 15 years on the team. Now, the current person in the role, Scott Jendresky, has done a terrific job. He is by far our best journalist. And I think I should give some perspective in that, you know, our funds, and this funds go back over 30 years, average holding period in the fund has been 5 years. And the average holding period of the top 10 names is, I think, about 9 years. And so if you are a genuinely long-term owner of businesses, and I think that very, very few managers are, you know, the decision-making of the top people at the organization, the culture, their capabilities, their how they're addressing challenges, how they compensate people, you know, are become incredibly important as you go further out into the future, right? And so, you know, having someone like Scott or a journalist on board, it allows us to, you know, essentially do background checks or, you know, personal profiles on executives that maybe we aren't sure about given their public profile. And it doesn't mean, you know, necessarily that they've done anything wrong. It's just they could be new to the role. They might just not have an extensive public profile that you can make a judgment on, right? There's, mm-hmm. you know, the thing I would say to this is it's hard to overstate how important the people are running a business. You know, the kind of thing the thing I try to point out to people is the question of, you know, apart from 5X, the shareholder return, what's the difference between, you know, if you go back to 2005, what's the difference between JP Morgan and Citigroup? You know, Citigroup was probably a better positioned bank at the time. And so what happened? You know, I think that the answer is simple. It's as simple as Jamie Dimon. One of them fired Jamie Dimon 5 years earlier, and the other one figured out a way to buy Bank One to get Jamie Dimon. And so that has made all the difference. And there are a number of businesses that operate that way. And we want to, you know, come at it from the people first perspective sometimes, not just kind of the, you know, financials side. And that's really where the journalist comes into play.
That's really interesting. Have there been examples where the research has kept you out of a position?
Yes, there are examples. And I, you know, I probably won't name them because some of them are recent. And, you know, I think there's people who I've got a lot of respect for. I think are in some of these stocks. But, you know, there are just a fair amount, like anything, there's a fair amount of like below average or professional or uninspiring managers. And you see all the time as kind of someone coming from the financial side of, you know, company X is well positioned. They have share. They have every reason to succeed. Why hasn't it worked? And, you know, and we've been in some of those. So, I mean, if you want a couple other examples of how important people are, I'd say take a look at the experience of a company called Esterline and the performance of those assets after it was bought by TransDigm. You know, is absolutely tremendous what can be done with the exact same asset under a different kind of environment. And then the one that we, you know, had a tremendous amount of benefit from is a company called Howmet, which had been a subsidiary of Alcoa, you know, long, long time ago. And when John Platt became CEO, it was, again, no acquisitions, no change in business mix, but you can track the performance of that business sort of starting on the day of his appointment. And it looks like nothing compared to its past, or, you know, it's a tremendous change just on the basis of really one individual being changed out there. And so we want to be, you know, it's imperfect and it's hard, it's very subjective, but we want to be open to those kind of ideas. You know, the other one that I think was pretty important for us is that, you know, we had a pretty meaningful position in a company called Broadcom, became Avago. And at the time that we got into it, if you rewind, these were like the days of Valiant, if you remember Valiant, and the roll up, you know, kind of idea that you could just sort of roll things up and cut all your costs. And there was a fair amount of controversy about the CEO, you know, at Broadcom at the time. I won't bore you with the story, but we did a tremendous amount of work on the person, you know, interviewing, you know, the original private equity sponsor who backed him, you know, decade earlier, talking to a number of people who had sold businesses to him, had worked with him and had left, and kind of came to the conclusion that even though, you know, Wall Street maybe had a narrative that he was, you know, Valiant 2.0, that there was really something else going on there. And that was all qualitative, you know, that wasn't in a spreadsheet. And that certainly was important for us.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, we only have time for one more, Brian, but I wanted to ask about working with Steve Romick, who's had such a long and distinguished investing career at FPA. Maybe you could share how Steve has impacted you as an investor.
Yeah, Steve's great. I've been working with Steve for 17 years, and then my other partner, Mark, for the last 16 years. And I'm grateful for both of them, you know, as partners, and also people I've learned a lot from. You know, in terms of Steve, you know, I think the big thing on the analytical side when I first joined or started working with Steve is Steve had a background in shorting. And so he did a fair amount of individual name shorts. And that, I think, caused him to have a focus on the bear side, right? There's always a bear case to an investment that was probably much greater than I did. And I think that was very helpful, right? So Steve is very, very big on the look down, always your first kind of idea. And I think that, you know, it's helpful to think through how might an investment X, Y, or Z not work, right? I mean, you talked about Vail earlier, right? There is a bear case. You want to identify the bear case. You want to understand what it would mean to the individual security, and you want to understand how it would impact the rest of your portfolio. And so I think that, you know, Steve really put that in my head in a way that, you know, probably wasn't before. And then, you know, the other thing, you know, I think that Steve should get a lot of credit for is that, you know, he has had, I think, the entire time since he started Crescent, you know, a focus on what the client's or LP's experience is, right? And, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with the stories of managers who have kind of tremendous long-term track records, but the actual result for their clients was sort of maybe even negative, I think, in some cases, but certainly is paled in comparison to the performance of the fund. So Steve has always, you know, wanted and impressed upon all of us the importance of the, you know, the LPs having actually a good experience in it and getting the returns of the fund, not just the fund putting up a, you know, impressive number or something.
Yeah.
And so those are, yeah, I think those are two things that very much, you know, Steve talks a lot about.
Does he do that through, is it mostly through communication? He just kind of urges them to stick with the fund through downturns and not buy low?
I think we try to be thoughtful in the letters we write, certainly. We try to be thoughtful in the, you know, call it quarterly calls. And then it's also just the mandate, right? It's coming up with a mandate, which is, you know, equity-like returns over time with less risk and pursuing it in a way so that we kind of never set the fund up to be in a position where we think you might be taking off the cliff, right? And so many funds, because of their narrow mandate, are kind of forced to stay in an investment, whether it's a geography, a style, whatever else it might be, even when it gets to a point where it doesn't make any sense, because that's sort of the business proposition they've had. And so if instead you just sort of structure it from the beginning with a business proposition that is, you know, flexible to avoid, you know, difficult decisions, as we talked about, and kind of to keep the portfolio disciplined, I think it just results in a more sustainable result for people.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us in the Long View. This has been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Long View. If you could, please take a moment to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow on socials at Dan Lefkowitz on LinkedIn. George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Greshek produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording and are subject to change without notice. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates, which together we refer to as Morningstar. Morningstar is not affiliated with guests or their business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. This recording is for informational purposes only, and the information, data, analysis, or opinion it includes or their use should not be considered investment or tax advice, and therefore is not an offer to buy or sell a security. Morningstar shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data, analyses, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances.